Greetings. You have tuned into the Better with Booze Film Club, a podcast where three film buffs watch films which they have not seen before and then foist their opinions on you, the listener. Proceed with caution and do not take their opinions as expert. They are barely professionals in their own careers. You have been warned.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Better with Booze Film Club podcast. Joining me on this week's episode are the Terrible Two. His hobbies include carving cloves of garlic into smaller cloves of garlic. It's Glenn.
Hello there.
And she can read the entire New York Times crossword puzzle clue section in one sitting. It's Sarah.
Hi.
And before we turn to our film this week, I'm going to throw it over to my two aforementioned co-hosts as they talk about the alcoholic beverage that they consumed for this week's podcast. Glenn and or Sarah.
All right, I will field it this time because
that's
I
Sarah.
Provided, yes, in case it wasn't clear, I am Sarah.
Glenn and has the girlier voice.
He does, in fact, yes. And he's the oldest one, in case we didn't mention it in this podcast yet.
By some amount.
So we drank something called Kona Big Wave Liquid Aloha from Kona Brewing Company, which is, you would think, based out of Hawaii.
I used to like Kona Brewing.
It is, in fact, based out of California, according
to
this here bottle.
They have some very good, some very decent beers.
Yeah, this, it was just like I feel like it would probably be this beer's equivalent of a Corona, almost. It's just sort of that light
standard
summer beer.
Yeah.
That's sort of what they do. They have a whole range of standard beers in every sort of beer category, like a standard IPA and a standard wheat and a standard.
And this, I mean, for me, that's very much what this was. This was a particular. It was perfectly drinkable. Yep. Nothing to write home about. It was very light, which is generally not my first choice. I tend to go for something that's a little more of the double IPA variety. A little bit. If I'm going to drink a beer, it should be 7% or higher because I don't like the taste of beer enough to just have one for the sake of sipping. This is a sipping beer for sure. But it was good. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it, certainly.
Nothing wrong with it at all. It was tasty.
Yeah, pretty good artwork as well.
Half the reason I got it is because I liked the shape of the bottle and I liked the design of it. It's nice.
It wasn't their old bottles, but I like the bottle.
It was eye-catching. So eye-catching packaging and a decent beer. So I would recommend
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
Glenn probably remembers the days of ponies.
Oh, yes, I do. Wide-mouth pony bottles. Yeah. 7-ounce Rolling Rocks.
Yeah. I don't know if they still make them. I would imagine they might.
It'd be cool if they did.
Yeah. Anywho. And now, with that out of the way, we move on to the film for this week. And for this episode, we watched the 1978 British horror film The Shout, starring a real cast of no-name actors, including Alan Bates, John Hurt, Susanna York, Tim Curry, and a literal blink-and-you-miss-him appearance by the not-yet-beloved acting institution that is Jim Broadbent. And I will now attempt to explain the story of The Shout, which is a difficult proposition for a film in which almost nothing happens and you understand none of it. The film opens at the end before we start at the beginning with a cricket match at a mental institution. Here we meet Crossley, played by Alan Bates, who is introduced to Robert Graves, played by Tim Curry. If the name Robert Graves rings a bell, it's because the character shares his name with a famous English author and poet named Robert Graves, who is commemorated, among other places, in Poets' Corner at Westminster Cathedral. It is also he who wrote a short story on which this film is based. But it is certainly not a true story, or at least one hopes. Anyway, during the cricket match, Crossley, who is scoring the match along with Graves, begins to tell him his companion a story. It is this story that is now told in film form. It involves a man named Anthony Fielding, played by John Hurt, who is an experimental music composer who lives in rural Devon with his wife, Rachel. One day, a man, also named Crossley, also played by Alan Bates, meets Fielding. He soon inserts himself into the couple's lives. At one point, he explains to Fielding how he learned an ancient technique from a shaman, which involves developing a scream so loud that it kills anyone and anything that hears it. He demonstrates the scream to Fielding in the middle of nowhere. Fielding is wearing ear protection, which allows him to just barely survive. A sheepherder and his flock are not so lucky. The story progresses with Crossley eventually seducing Fielding's wife by the use of a missing shoe buckle. All the while, we keep cutting back to the other Crossley at the cricket match as he tells the story to Graves. Here's where I'm going to stop the synopsis, as revealing any more would sort of ruin the ending, and truth be told, I'm not sure I understand the ending anyway. So, we now turn to what I suspect will be a difficult part on the part of my two co-hosts, the moment of optimism for the film. And while they churn through their brain banks to pick something that they liked, I will start by saying that... My moment of optimism, I think, is the fact that it's a 1970s horror film, and I'll explain it this way, is that I think the cinematography in a 1970s horror film makes me particularly unnerved.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of parts of this that have a sort of unsettling film quality to them.
Yes.
Which is true of a lot of 1970s horror films. And yeah. I appreciate that sort of style of it's quiet, but the shots are kind of eerie, but they're not eerie for any particular reason. And the order makes them sort of weird and eerie. Mm-hmm.
I thought of Suspiria, like Dario Argento's Suspiria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, he did that too. Obviously not British, but more Italian, but. He had that similar thing. But it also, like, The Omen had a lot of that sort of
The Omen
in it. Yeah. Although The Omen had a lot more actual violent horror in it as well. Yeah. But it's something about 1970s British horror films that I quite appreciate. And I would put this in that category. We'll go to Glenn now. I left some acting open for you because there's some good acting roles.
There is some good acting from some fine actors in there. I'm thinking the dog primarily.
Amen.
I quite liked the dog. Yeah,
beautiful lab.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yellow lab. I like Susanna York. I thought she was good in this. What I liked about this with her is she was definitely playing outside of her normal type.
And significantly outside of her normal type, about 10 miles outside of her normal type.
And it was kind of cool to see her do that. And I liked that. So that for me was kind of like, oh, that's kind of neat. I like to see what she can really do as an actress. So,
mostly show her breasts.
Yes, she
there
did.
There was a lot of that. Yep.
Sarah.
It's kind of a piggyback off of Glenn's, but
I like Susanna York.
Well, in general, I would say that it was fun, whether every single performance was stellar or not. It was very fun to see everybody in this film because you've got a baby Tim Curry. I mean, granted, he's in it for probably collectively 5 minutes of the film, but he is there and it's fun to see his face and just picking.
Rocky Horror was when?
It was before this.
Mm-hmm. Was it before this?
Yeah.
Okay.
I know.
Because this is kind of a bit role.
It really is a bit role. Yeah. It's a very, very small role, but it was fun to see him. It was fun to see John Hurt. It was, just everybody very young playing something that other than Tim Curry, because he does a lot of horror-related genre.
Well, John Hurt does some as well.
Yeah.
That's true. Nothing that I've personally seen, at least. Yeah. So it was nice to see all of them do something, and very, very young, all of them.
And it's also kind of a standard Alan Bates role, although not necessarily in a horror film.
Right, right.
So yeah, and he was good. Yeah, I thought they all did a good job. All of the familiar faces did a good job because they are all good actors.
Yeah.
Okay, and now we'll move into the general discussion of the film. I suspect I had a more generous take on the film than my co-hosts. I also developed some theories. Actually, more so on the second time of watching it.
Oh, I'd like to hear those theories.
Same.
Yeah, but I would forgive somebody for using a term like convoluted or, a phrase difficult to follow or... But here's my... Again, I'm going to try to keep this relatively spoiler alert.
Spoiler free.
Okay. Although I don't know that I can, because the whole film is kind of a spoiler. But I'm going to say my theory is none of it actually happened.
Yeah, I could see. I could see that.
That it's just Alan Bates' character telling a story. Because he says at the beginning, I've told this story many times, it changes.
Changed yeah. this here, this right. there. Yeah, just to keep
so
it alive.
So I think the whole thing is just something he made up during the cricket match to tell the Tim Curry character.
See, and I would agree with that, except for the one thing that happens at the very end when they open up the cart.
But I think that's just coincidence.
You
I
think it's just pure coincidence.
I think the cart just happened to have been struck by...
Yeah.
Just to happen to...
Yeah. Hit by lightning.
Which yeah. is fair. I mean, and that would lend itself to the idea that it's all in his head, which is a realistic thought.
I
could see that. I could yeah. definitely see that.
Hmm.
And because at the beginning, you think that his character is a doctor.
Yeah.
Correct.
With another facility somewhere.
It, yeah.
Right.
And then at the end, Tim Curry, it's dawning on Tim Curry
yeah.
that he's actually a patient, not a doctor.
So this is just Shutter Island before Shutter Island was cool, pretty much.
So that was yeah. my theory. And once you accept that theory, the film itself actually becomes better. Like, if you sink into that theory, the film becomes better.
Yeah, because, let's go back in and watch it again.
Okay. Because there is a lot of interesting things in the film. Mm-hmm. And none of it makes sense unless you sort of adopt that as a theory.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which would be fair, because one of my biggest complaints about the film is the fact that for most of it, you don't know what the hell is going on. But if you have an unreliable narrator who is sort of doing it inconsistently and is losing his own mind, then it would make sense that the film itself would be completely haphazard and a total mess. Are we giving it more credit than it deserves, I guess, would be the question that I have.
And another thing yeah. that lends credit potentially to that theory sure. is that Susanna York's character at the end is a nurse.
She's a nurse in there. That's yeah. true. Yep.
And he must have been one of her patients.
Yeah.
And that's why he factored her into the story that he was
trying. Yeah, because I couldn't.
Because John Hurt was also playing cricket.
He was playing cricket.
But it's never really, it's not clear
who he is.
Although that's a fair
so
point.
I think he just saw John Hurt and brought him into the story.
Yeah. Yeah.
See, and I think that could definitely be the case, which just makes me wish they'd done a better job actually pulling the story together so that if mm-hmm. that were the case, that sort of not twist ending, but sort of, it feels like more of a...
Well, I caught on just because you were too slow.
Well, you got to see it twice. You got to see it twice.
And I have to say, it's probably a pretty interesting short story, which I've never read.
Yeah, but... I could see it being an interesting
story. And by the way,
story.
If you want to read a really fascinating life, it's the real life author of the short story, led a crazy life.
Hmm.
Robert Graves. Yeah.
Not Rupert Graves.
No. Different Graves. Bonkers life.
Yeah.
Also not Peter that Graves.
Yeah, it would. I like your take on it, because otherwise this movie is just a dumpster fire.
100%.
Yeah.
1,000%.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And that does make you see it quite differently. Well, I'll say more later. Yeah.
Sure.
Other than that, the music is interesting. I liked the sort of scenes when him like experimenting with his experimental music thing, because it's sort of, that's what it would have been like. It would have not. I mean, you hear a Pink Floyd album and you're like, wow. But then you realize it's just like 12 hours of them in a shed somewhere trying to figure out how to.
Yeah.
I feel like this was the skeleton of what could have been a really interesting horror film.
Mm.
But it was, and maybe this is just me, I found it incredibly boring.
Boring. Yeah.
I thought the entire time I was just sort of waiting for things to escalate. And then when things did finally escalate, it was so shambolic that it didn't even really pack any kind of punch, because you're so busy trying to figure out what the heck is going on with everybody. Like when he runs back into the desert and starts digging through the sand for,
stones.
And then he's something like...
Not technically a desert, but...
Or the dunes.
There are no deserts in Devon.
Fair point. The dunes. When he's wandering through the dunes and he finds a stone and he finds the right stone somehow, we do not know why he figures out that that's exactly the one
because
that he's looking
because
for.
Because it never happened.
Well, and which it would be, if that is the case, then yes, this makes perfect sense that it would be utter nonsense. But then they needed to do a much better job at the beginning and end. Because I agree, I thought it
was
interesting.
Stop hitting the table, Sarah.
Sorry. I thought it was interesting.
Every podcast.
I do. I have a bad habit of it. But it was interesting that she showed up as a nurse and that he was playing cricket. But I was so busy trying to figure out what the heck was going on in the actual story that I just sort of threw it away as like, oh, they're just there because they survived the debacle.
It probably does help to have watched it a second time.
Yeah.
Because then you start picking up on these things.
Right. Fair.
Where like, this makes sense if he's making it up and these little weird things keep changing because he's changing the story as he tells it.
Right. Even with that, I think some of the scenes just didn't work, and it was boring. To me, it was the equivalent of that road trip where, you know, you're just constantly going, are we there yet?
Mm-hmm.
I do agree that some of the scenes don't work.
I never found it boring, though, but that's because, again, 1970s British horror films, I enjoy looking at them, so I never really got...
And it did have some pretty interesting camera, you know, photography, camera moves, things like that.
Some of them were borderline slightly too arty, but I understand why they did
it
like that.
I kept thinking, you're trying to be avant-garde, but you're not quite there.
The weird paintings, transitions, black and white thing.
It was probably a step too far. Like the Alan Bates, Susanna York conversation was like half faces. I'm like, this is now becoming a little too arty.
Yeah.
Just scale it back a little bit.
Yeah.
But like the interesting things, like the mirror thing coming out of building, and you're like, I don't know why they showed that, and maybe there's no reason that they showed that,
right?
But it was interesting,
yeah.
And that made you think, why are they showing me that? Yeah. Is this a red herring, or is this like the Omen, and they're showing me something that's going to happen in the?
So if this is all in his mind, and I still like that take.
I do too.
How is he telling us stuff about things where he wasn't present? Or he's just making everything up.
He's just making it up.
So their whole lives, he's making up their lives.
Correct.
Going to the cobbler to get shoes fixed, all that stuff.
I think he saw him playing a cricket match and said, that's my main character.
That's my dude.
My nurse is going to be his wife.
Okay.
And I assume that he's in prison because we do know that he did kill
his children.
That at the very least is true.
And again, I think he's made up in his story that it was an Aboriginal thing. But I think in real life,
he probably murdered his children.
He just did it. And that's why he's there.
Yeah.
Which, again, would all of that would make for a... And I bet watching it the second time, it would be more enjoyable because you're thinking about it that way. But you shouldn't have to do
that. Because at the end, the police show up to arrest him for murdering his children.
That makes it weird, though.
No, because that would only happen if he's making up the story because they wouldn't have known he murdered if it was some sort of Aboriginal thing.
Yeah, but
so is
that how he got there? Did the police actually arrest him in their house, or did he make up that he was arrested in their home?
I think the part that was real was the police arrested him. I think he made up the part where he killed the police because of his shout.
And was arrested in their home.
And I don't think any of that happened.
Yeah, gotcha.
I think like reality started slightly.
Mind blown.
Because toward the end, reality started sort of slipping into the story.
Yeah, it did. Okay.
Where did he get the bone?
And why was
he sharpening? Because if he's a patient, he really needs to do a better job with their security. my God.
He found it in the field, you know, whatever.
I also thought, and I said this at the beginning of the movie, and I didn't think it really improved. It really did feel like a 12-year-old with PowerPoint as the transition editor was the one put in charge, because every single transition was really choppy or really awkward, and they would also flash to things that didn't matter.
But again, that's also sort of a 1970s and maybe that's the British thing. Horror
maybe
thing.
This just isn't made for me.
Like strange quick cuts and
because I don't like kind of that type of horror. I do like horror that's a little bit more ambiance heavy and a little less like
Sarah wants people murdered.
Honestly, if we're gonna let's just do it.
This is a less horror, more gore.
I think that this could have packed a much more effective punch, and I think it's a push to call it a horror movie. I think it's a real push to call it a horror movie.
I agree.
Yeah, but horror is such a weird category.
Psychological thriller?
Because really,
thriller feels like a stretch.
Is like Psycho a horror film, and yet it's considered like the godfather of horror films? I mean, horror is such a weird genre title to begin with, because do you consider Saw a horror film? It's not really a horror. No. It's just sort of...
Gore.
Just gore for the sake of
it's
gore.
It's a slasher film, really. But are slasher films horror films? What is a horror film?
That's fair. That's a fair point. It is a very personal opinion on horror because so many people have so many different types that they like.
I mean, I would classify Alfred Hitchcock as a suspense director, but he's considered sort of a horror director.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not really horror films.
They're more thriller.
Yeah.
It's a very... strange, like Halloween's a horror film, but it's not really that
subjective.
It's really more of a
it's kind of a suspense film.
There's not that much slashing goes on, and for like the first bit of the film almost nothing happens. It's a lot of buildup of tension,
yeah
And then it's become a slasher film now, obviously, with its 1,200 sequels.
But oh, my God, so many.
When he met Freddy for the first time, it was all downhill. Well, I think we've probably beaten a dead sheep long enough. So we'll go with the... whether we are saying skip or see for this film, it's going to be interesting. I suspect I know what the end results are going to be, but we'll start with Sarah.
I'm going to say skip, and I'm going to say skip with the acknowledgement that this might just not be a movie for me, and it's maybe just not a type of horror film that I like, but I think I had to work way too hard to stay engaged because it was as scatter as it was, and it went from nothing happening to everything happening all at once, and I think the jarring pacing made it ineffective as a horror film. So for me, I think there are better ones in the genre and probably better performances by these actors that are worth going out and looking for.
Okay, Glenn.
I am also going to give it a skip, and it's a darn solid skip for me because I can't ever recommend anybody seeing this movie. It did, I think, what it was trying to do, but it didn't let me in on what it was trying to do.
That's a good way to put it. Watching it.
And I wanted to be in a little bit more because I think I would have enjoyed it better if they had tipped the hat a little bit earlier. Because that's not a good, if it's even a twist that he's making all this up. It's not even a good twist. It's just let us know that and
give us crumbs throughout to sort of set that up.
He's the unreliable narrator, et cetera. So I don't know. I didn't enjoy it. And I love 70s horror movies. I love 60s horror movies. I've seen these people do a lot better in other things too. So yeah, it's a skip from me.
Before I give you mine, I will give you a earth-shattering revelation.
Ah, yes.
This film, The Shout,
yes,
won the Grand Jury Prize at the Cannes Film Festival.
So they were still doing acid then.
Yeah, okay. Apparently. Maybe that's the trick. Maybe we just went into this wrong. We needed something stronger than beer.
And was nominated. That's it.
We had the wrong booze for
and
this
was
movie.
Nominated for the grand prize at the Cannes Film Festival.
Oh my gosh. Wow. We missed something.
That being said, I am actually going to give it a mild C.
Okay.
Because I actually think it's probably more interesting than my two co-hosts do. And I had to sit through it twice, so... There's obviously something in it because I paid attention the second time as well because my theories were being developed.
Nice. It was a good theory.
Yeah.
So a mild C and two relatively non-mild skips for you. And with that, we turn to our favorite segment of this particular podcast.
You want me to hold the chicken, huh?
What's the one thing?
Do you expect me to talk?
Why don't you just make 10 louder?
Surely you can't be serious.
Do you like apples?
I'm asking you who's on first.
Is it safe?
You talking to me?
You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve?
You want answers?
Well, do you, Bunk?
Daddy, what are you rebelling against?
Shall we play a game?
Too little short for a stormtrooper.
What's in the box?
Hey, is it my imagination or is it getting crowded here? Yeah.
That's right. It's time for the trivia round, in which I ask my co-hosts 5 questions they can't possibly know the answer to and see which of them stumbles into the most luck. And this week's topic is John Hurt.
Oh, all right.
Question number 1. John Hurt was born in Chesterfield in the middle of England to Arnold and Phyllis Hurt. His mother was, conveniently, a one-time actress. But what was the profession of his father? Was he A, grocer, B, a banker, C, a vicar, or D, a musician? We'll start with Sarah. Oh, pretend like you're thinking and not just going to pick one at random.
I am thinking. You know what? I'm going to go with vicar. Just because what a cool backstory.
Glenn.
I wanted to go with vicar too. Ah.
Are you going with vicar? Are you picking a different
one? I'm going with vicar.
Oh.
I can proudly announce that you are both correct.
He was vicar. See, this is what happens when Glenn cheats.
Yes. Question number 2. John Hurt attended several acting schools and at one point did what to help pay for tuition? Was that A, worked as a shoe salesman in a women's boutique store? B, sold nude sketches of his friends? C, participated in experimental drug trials? Or D, sold stolen cigarettes for a local gang?
Oh my god.
I love this. He looks like he participated in drug trials.
He does.
I'm going to go with the selling of stolen cigarettes.
Okay, Sarah.
I'm going to go with the selling of women's shoes.
Mm. Okay, I can announce that both of you are wrong. Damn. He actually sold nude sketches of his friends.
Okay.
Question number three. After a few bit roles and a television jobs, John Hurt landed his first major role in 1966 in a film which also saw an appearance by which other star from The Shout? Is that A, Alan Bates, B, Robert Stevens, C, Susanna York, or D, Tim Curry? Robert Stevens, by the way, was the head of the psychiatric.
Yeah.
Facility. Gotcha.
Yeah. Wow.
The one that sort of looks like Barry.
What the hell? Alan Bates.
Sarah.
I'm going to go with Susanna York.
The answer is, in fact, Susanna York.
Yay! Yes,
nice job.
And the film was A Man for All Seasons.
Oh, there you go.
Okay.
Question number four. John Hurt was a much sought after and respected actor during his lifetime, but which director once claimed he was, quote, simply the greatest actor in the world, end quote? Was that A, David Lynch, B, Ridley Scott, C, Steven Spielberg, or D, Sam Peckinpah?
Dang, oof. Man. High praise from some big names there, at least one of them.
No, they're all big names.
No, I mean, only one of them gave him the high praise.
Go through them again.
A, David Lynch. B, Ridley Scott. C, Steven Spielberg. D, Sam Peckinpah. And before you ask, yes, he appeared in films by all of them.
Yeah. I'm going to say Dave. He's a David Lynch kind of guy.
Okay.
I'm going to go with Sam Peckinpah.
It was, in fact, A, David Lynch.
Ooh,
well right. done.
In which he appeared in his Elephant Man.
Oh.
So if I could test myself. B, Ridley Scott, he was in Alien. C, Steven Spielberg, he was in the fourth Indiana Jones film.
Yeah.
And Sam Peckinpah, he was in his last film.
But I don't remember what that is.
I can't remember the name of it.
Yeah. Not The Wild Bunch.
No. Anyway, question number five. For all the winnings, really, because you're currently tied.
Uh-oh.
Question number five. Shortly before passing away, John Hurt was cast to play which British prime minister, but had to be recast when ill health meant he could not attend the read-throughs. Was that A, Stanley Baldwin, B, Neville Chamberlain, C, Clement Attlee, or D, Anthony Eden?
Oh, my God.
Which one's your favorite prime minister?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really a fan of all four, so it's tough.
I don't even remember most of the names you just said, but I'll say the last one.
Well,
was that Eden?
Eden, yeah.
Yeah.
Three conservatives and a Labour prime minister. Which do you want?
Yeah.
That guy. I'm going to go with Chamberlain.
Okay. The correct answer is B, Neville Chamberlain.
Yeah!
And it was for the film The Darkest Hour with Gary Oldman.
So here's the thing. Okay. I had a feeling it was going to be The Darkest Hour because it was the only thing I could think of that was in that would recently that would have had someone like that. But I didn't know that guy was in it. So it was still total
to
guess.
To be fair, The Darkest Hour featured Neville Chamberlain, Clement Attlee, and Anthony Eden.
So, oh, jeez. Yeah, right. I had that movie on the brain, but I had no clue that guy was in it.
So Sarah, for the triumphant victory, guessed her way to the win. So Glenn will be responsible for bringing beer.
Perfect.
Wah, wah. And now we move on to our segment that we are calling, because we have no better name for it, Listener Questions.
Yay.
In which, as should be fairly self-explanatory, we answer listener questions. And today we have two questions, both quite similar in nature, asked by two different people. And we will start with one from longtime bestie, no-time listener, Isaiah. Who would like to know the following. Which is your favorite actor to play James Bond and why? I can tell you what Isaiah's answer would be.
Yeah.
Which I'm thinking would be Daniel Craig, because Isaiah has no knowledge of anything past.
That's probably his first James Bond, right?
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Man. See, this is tough because different James Bonds
things to the table.
I have a definitive answer.
So my first and my favorite had always been Roger Moore.
Yes.
Now, I think Daniel Craig was in the best James Bond movie I ever saw, and he was outstanding in it in Casino Royale.
Yes,
which is not my favorite Daniel Craig James Bond film.
But I'm going to stick with Roger Moore.
Okay.
And I am going to go Daniel Craig, and it's largely because of the fact that I really like his films. With the exception of Quantum of Solace, I think they are all solid films. Great. Skyfall, I liked Spectre, I really liked Casino Royale, of course. That was a phenomenal first film. I would say him, but I have to admit it is probably more due to the film and the cast and everyone else that goes into those movies that makes him my favorite.
Yeah, I get it. I want to put Daniel Craig ahead of Roger Moore. He was my first and sort of...
You're loyal. I respect that.
Had this been the final question in the trivia round, Glenn would have won, but unfortunately it is not. So Sarah, you are still the winner. I'm going to go with Roger Moore.
Okay.
Because I think James Bond can have a tendency to get way too serious about itself.
Yeah.
Sure.
And Roger Moore defiantly pushed back against
he
that
did.
And,
he did.
And brought the camp value. Now, I will say some of the worst James Bond films Roger Moore films.
Yeah.
Some of the best James Bond films are arguably Daniel Craig films, mm-hmm. but my problem is I would like the Daniel Craig films if they weren't James Bond films. Because he's not James Bond.
Yeah, that's fair.
He's like a superhero.
He's an action hero.
But he's not James Bond. He's not a spy.
He's not suave.
I mean, arguably none of them were particularly like stealthy and subtle.
No.
But they were more so at the beginning than they became when everything was an explosion and jumping off of rooftops on motorcycles and everybody knew who you were. And
that is very, very true. He is, of all of the James Bond, it is fair to say that Daniel Craig is the least James Bond of the James Bonds.
Yes.
Most likely to win a fight among all the James Bonds
1,000%,
as well.
But also he is the least James Bondsy of the bunch of them.
Yes. And I'm going to put a special mention out for Pierce Brosnan, who I think people sort of forget these days because I enjoy him. Daniel Craig sort of overtook his.
Yeah. And I think Timothy Dalton got a bad rap, but he was in James Bond films that had really bad storylines and plots.
His two James Bond films were terrible.
Bad. And he's so good.
He is very good. And he's very likable and he's a very good actor. And he was actually not bad in the films, but he had nothing to work with.
And George Lazenby was, a one-time James Bond.
And also not a particularly James Bondy James Bond story.
Yeah. It should have been a much better movie.
Yes.
And although it gets rated fairly high a lot. I'm not exactly sure why.
I think it's because it shows a different side.
On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
I think it's because it showed a different side of James Bond.
I guess.
And he's like emotional and he, you know.
Yeah.
He's
yeah.
very un-
Gets James, married.
He's a very un-James Bond. But if I'm criticizing Daniel Craig for being too action hero, the George Lazenby probably goes in the other direction of being too much like George Smiley than he is James Bond.
And honestly, the most recent Daniel Craig James Bond was for sure the least James Bondsy James Bond they've
done. My favorite of the Daniel Craig ones.
It's a fantastic
because
movie.
It's a throwback to the old campy sort of.
It is 100%, but he himself is like explosive, all over the place, doing his usual like kind of the James Bond that Daniel Craig has kind of clearly defined as a bit disastrous, overall charming.
I'm
like
of the one
you're not thinking of the most recent one. You're thinking of Spectre.
Spectre is my favorite one.
Correct.
Yes.
Because I think that's the most
Spectre.
Like an old Bond film.
It is.
Yeah, Spectre is the best of his.
I have not seen the most recent one. To be fair,
it's fine.
It looked a little too Mission Impossible.
I was just
going to
say
when I saw the trailer for it. I'm like, this is just another Tom Cruise Mission Impossible.
It is, which I mean, I love the Mission Impossible movies, but yes, it was definitely leaning a lot more heavy towards Mission Impossible, a lot less espionage. But Spectre is my absolute favorite of the Daniel Craig ones. Go.
And then, by the way, no one said anything about Sean Connery.
No, they didn't.
Feel bad.
His James Bond's a little creepy, though. We're only viewing it through modern eyes, I realize.
Yeah.
But he was, like, not a particularly nice person.
Right.
Like, his character was not particularly
cold.
Nice.
No, yeah.
Even disregarding all the sort of problems with women in the early films, he was just not a very likable person.
Yes, when he pats somebody on the rear end and tells them to scoot because it's time for man talk.
Yeah.
Didn't age well.
Yeah.
Nope.
Ouch.
Although, Goldfinger is an excellent film.
Mm-hmm.
And the second question from Elisa, similar lines. Her question is, which is your favorite film or television version of Batman and why? I have a definitive answer on this one as well.
Oh, actually, I do have a definitive one.
All right.
I had to think about it for a second.
And I will say, before anyone gives their answers, I will put this caveat out there. I think the best Batman has to be somebody who can play both Batman
and Bruce Wayne.
Absolutely.
And very few people get both of them correct.
Okay. I agree with that. Now, are we saying best Batman, favorite Batman film, or favorite Batman
It can be film
version character,
film or television.
Okay.
Yes.
But the character,
the character specific. Okay. Because I have a favorite Batman movie, but it's less because of the portrayal and more because of just the animation style and everything about it is great. It's called Flashpoint. Great series, but not so Batman heavy. That is a tough one because I like them all for different reasons.
I think we know what our answers are. Well, I don't know. Glenn, you can go if you've got one.
I want to hear yours.
I mean, mine is my original Batman, really, and it's Michael Keaton.
He is very good.
Who is very good at playing Batman, but also very good at playing Bruce Wayne, which I feel like everybody goes on and on about Christian Bale. He was the worst Bruce Wayne of the people who played Batman. And he was okay. Agreed. He was good as Batman. George Clooney, good at playing Bruce Wayne. Terrible at playing Batman.
I think his Batman was Bruce Wayne. It wasn't great.
It was like an old 1950s where he took off the boxy business suit and put on a slightly less boxy outfit and everybody goes, well, that's the same person. He's just put on a little mask.
Yeah. Now I'm going to throw some props. This is not my favorite, but I'm going to first throw some props to Val Kilmer, who I think did a very nice job as both. Yes. Batman and Bruce
and
Wayne.
He did. In a pretty thankless film.
Absolutely. Because that was not a good one. No. And but I think he did a really nice job. Now, it's tempting for me to go back to my childhood.
I know where you're going.
And I think he should get a Batman television series. And he should definitely. Adam West.
Yeah.
Oh, he started it all.
Well, he didn't, but he's
the one people most know of. Yeah.
Because it set out to do Batman as campy as it could be,
and
it
just nailed it.
Yes, it did.
Nailed it, and he was so good at his campy Batman and his straight-laced millionaire Bruce Wayne. I really like that, but I do have to go with my very favorite Batman is Michael Keaton.
Yes,
absolutely.
Yeah,
the Batman.
He's so good.
Yeah, I have to go Michael Keaton as well. I got to say, he is so, so, so good as both.
And I'll add, sorry to interrupt,
no, please.
But he was the one I thought would be terrible as Batman. When they announced it was going to be, you know, comedian, comic actor Michael Keaton as Batman. But I just thought, oh, they're not going to make him be Batman. This is going to stink. And then he just knocked it out of the park. Yeah.
Well, and he came back and played it not that long ago, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And he was good.
I have not seen it, but...
Yeah.
I also have to say, I have not seen Twinkly Body's Twilight Boy.
I was just going to talk about him because I have seen it.
Apparently very good.
It is very good. And I can see him being quite good in both of the roles.
He actually did
both the roles. If anything, my one criticism of that film is that he did not get more screen time. Because I do think that they...
Well, that's a problem with a lot of Batman
100%.
Films. They forget that the films are about Batman.
Absolutely.
Dark Knight, by the way.
Yes, no exception. And I think that, honestly, I think they were a little bit worried about how he was going to be received. So because they didn't know how he was going to do, they just... packed and packed and packed this movie with a whole bunch of stuff that was really not necessary to the plot. And I think if they had just given him the chance to be young, broody, up and coming, coming into his own Batman, he could have done it. He could have carried the whole film on his own without the need of all the distraction.
He's a much better actor than people give him credit for. Because he's been sort of unfortunately painted with this Twilight brush.
And he was very good in this. It's a different take on the character. I will say that. He's a young sad boy, for lack of a better way to say it.
As like, Bruce Wayne would have been as a child.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I think he's playing...
Bruce Wayne is basically an emo character.
He is. Yeah. And he's capturing that essence extremely well. And instead of going the direction of like the millionaire charmer, they're starting with the social recluse who eventually grows into that. And I thought he killed it.
He really did a phenomenal job
in an okay movie, which is why it's hard to put him in the running because I love the Michael Keaton Batman movies as well. And this was a great performance in a kind of crappy film.
Well, and following up after Ben Affleck, basically, if he didn't fall down at any point during the film, he would have been considered a better Batman. Sorry, Ben Affleck, but oof.
Well, he wasn't great. No.
It was not your finest hour. Just stop trying to play superheroes, I think is basically the moral of that story. You tried it once and it did not go well, and you thought, let me take another swing at that one. With that out of the way, and thank you for the questions, by the way, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Very thoughtful. Yeah. It's time for recommendations, and I'll kick things off. My recommendation is a 1990 acting class starring John Hurt called The Field. Ooh. John Hurt is unbelievably good in it, but the best acting in it belongs to a one Richard Harris. It may, in fact, be his best acting role I've ever seen him in, and he has a lifetime of very, very good acting roles. Yes. The Field.
Nice. I hadn't even heard
it's a bit of a sleeper film, but it's really, really good.
Nice.
Glenn.
I'm going to, since, are we allowed to say what time of year it is right now?
No.
Okay. Well, since.
Because it won't be this time of year.
At some point, it will be that time of year when the, you know, when we talk about spooks and ghouls and goblins.
It's probably passed already by some margin, but sure.
Yeah.
Well, a couple months ago when we had Halloween.
We can just edit this part out then.
Sure.
I'm going to, regardless, I'm going to recommend one of my favorite movies, and it's a lot of fun and a little creepy. It's called Arsenic. And Old Lace from 1934.
Yeah. That's a Halloween film. That's just fun.
It's literally on Halloween. It's about Halloween
Does it take
night.
It place in Halloween.
They reference it that it is Halloween night in the movie.
Yeah, but that's such a small thing compared to everything else that goes on.
And Cary Grant, Priscilla Lane, Raymond Massey, who's awesome, Peter Lloyd. The whole cast is amazing, including old Josephine Hull, one of the doughty aunts there that are in this film. I love it. Arsenic and Old Lace.
Is this very good?
Yeah.
Peter Lorre, maybe my favorite Peter Lorre character.
So great.
Because he's basically playing, like, it's weird. It's like a meta Peter Lorre character.
It is.
It's a caricature of a Peter Lorre character played by Peter Lorre.
Yes.
It's so bizarre.
Absolutely awesome.
That does sound awesome.
Sarah.
Well, given that we just watched a horror film and, you know, Glenn's recommending a horror, I'm going to just stay within the genre.
Arsenic and Old Lace, by the way, not a horror
film. No, that's fair.
It's a comedy.
It's a slapstick comedy.
But it takes place in spooky season.
Yes.
But because we just watched horror, I am going to recommend really anything by Mike Flanagan, but specifically what I'm going to recommend is The Fall of the House of Usher, which just came out, which is the
add-on. Surely that's more Poe, really.
It is more Poe, but he's pivoted from his Midnight Mass and Hill House and Bly Manor, and now he's doing the works of Poe. So his first one is Fall of the House of Usher, and it is a fascinating take on the story. And it's the same cast of characters, it's the same cast that you see in the previous films because he likes to use all of the same people. But his take on the story itself is fascinating. Plus, Mark Hamill's in it. So, I mean, if for no other reason, watch Mark Hamill.
I think I saw something about that because I said, isn't that Mark Hamill?
It is a stacked.
Because he doesn't do very much.
It is a stacked cast. It's a phenomenal cast. It's really, really well written. I mean, really, again, anything by Mike Flanagan, I love his particular brand of horror.
Poe is a tricky one, too, because not many people can do Poe. Try to do Poe. People don't try to do Poe, I think mostly because it's very hard to pull off.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. And I think maybe because of that, he has taken a very, very creative route with telling the story. And it's very cool to see, because I've read the story, so I have some understanding
of it. Is it again?
Fall of the House of Usher.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So it's very, very cool to see him apply it to, like, essentially a crime family for all intents and purposes. It's a really cool take on the story.
Interesting.
And everyone in it does a phenomenal job. I love Carly Gugino.
What year? It just came out
2 weeks ago.
Oh.
Yes.
Right. I guess if you think about it, not much goes on in Poe stories. I mean, there's not a whole lot of meat. Like, the Cassidy Amato has a very specific...
Well, right.
It's like
one room.
Hitting the pendulums the same way.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what allows you to do a lot with it, because it's such an atmospheric-driven story and character-driven. And I think that's what makes it so fun, because you can tell they're all... And plus, they all do horror so well. Every single member of the cast always kills it. So it's exciting to see them in this new take on an old classic.
Nice.
Well, there you go. Spooky-ish recommendations for an undisclosed time period, which may or may not be somewhere near Halloween, depending on when this episode goes up. So there you go. Have a spooky October/November/December.
Yeah.
Perfect. Halloween in Christmas. Anyway, with that, we've sadly reached the end of another episode of the Better with Booze Film Club podcast. I would like to thank my co-hosts Glenn and Sarah, although not that much, and I'd like to thank you for listening, especially. If you would like to be helpful, as I know you all would be, it would be very kind of you to pass the word along about this humble little podcast to as many people as you can. It would be very appreciated. We're desperate for listeners.
He's literally on his knees at the microphone.
Begging. Not a visual medium, but yes.
I am not. If you'd like to get in touch with us and maybe ask us a question, preferably not about James Bond or Batman, you could do so by emailing us at bwbfilmclub@gmail.com. That's bwbfilmclub@gmail.com. And I leave you with this one last thought. If one of your friendships comes with an ear protection required sign, maybe it's time to reevaluate. And of course, come on, you hatters.